Welcome to Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode 22, and I call this From Vegas to Macau plus special surprise. So I'll tell you all about that, but how does the gambling movie as headed by God of Gamblers director Wong Jing fare in 2014 when From Vegas to Macau was made? Well, it fares financially rather well, as From Vegas to Macau 1 and 2 proved. So with me, Kenny B, is my co-host from the Podcast on Fire series Gambling Season, Paul Fox. So say hi, buddy.
Hi, how's it going?
Hello, hello, and welcome to the bonus section of the website that not many people look at, but they are very, very much fun to do in concept, I think, these website-exclusive bonus chats. There are almost full episodes anyway, so I hope whoever's listening, thank you very much for following us to the website and catching this exclusive chat on a new gambling movie. And if you stick with us throughout the entire review of From Vegas to Macau, starring Chai Yun-fat, Nick Tse, and Chapman Toh, we have a special surprise for you. It'll come around about the halfway point of this episode, roughly, I'd imagine. So stick with us to hear what the surprise is. But for now, let's get into it. From Vegas to Macau from 2014, and plot from the Love HK film review of the film. So here we go. Cool, played by Nicolas Tse, his father Benz, played by Hoi Soo-hung. Isn't that his English name, by the way? Benz Hoi?
Yes, Benz Hoi is correct.
Wow, there you go. And cousin Carl, played by Chapman Toh, are Robin Hoods of the underworld who steal from bad guys and give to the poor. The three head to Macau to meet Ben's buddy Ken, played by Chai Yun-fat, a former gambling king who's now a security specialist for casinos and supposedly has the ability to read cards with only his fingertips. Cool wants to be Ken's apprentice, but Ken is slow to agree. Complicating matters is Ken's daughter Rainbow, played by Kimmy Tong, who lusts after Cool. I don't think it was that pronounced, that she lusts after him. It was not like sexual in that regard, but whatever. While Carl, Chapman Toh's character, lusts after Rainbow, and the audience snores at this lame love triangle. That is Koso's plot and not me. Meanwhile, Cool's half-brother, undercover agent Lionel, played by Philip M, runs afoul of Mr. Ko, played by Guo Hu, the CEO of DOA, the most professional money laundering company in the world. Seeking justice, Lionel's partner Lok Chi Man, played by Jing Tian, and Inspector Lee, played by Michael Wong. That's just wrong, by the way. It's Inspector Michael or Inspector Wong, not Inspector Lee. It's like they wanted to cast Danny Lee, but got Michael Wong and forgot to change the name. Her and Inspector Lee ask Ken to beat Mr. Ko at gambling, thus hurting his pride and making him mad, after which the authorities will nail him when he makes the inevitable mistake and seeks revenge. All very complicated, not very complicated to follow, and for my short opinion, it's awful. Oh my god, is it awful. Glimpses are here of Chai Yun-fat having a ball, but ultimately, this is all awful. To be fair, the gambling movie involving Wong Jing and Chai Yun-fat stopped being good in 1994 anyway, because their sequel, God of Gamblers Return, while it had its moments, it's not very good. So we haven't been waiting for like another masterpiece or anything after two masterpieces prior. But gambling movie business is strong, as I alluded to, but not the actual gambling movie quality based on the movie here. And also, this stars Chapman Toh as the actor who ruins the film, which is a phrase I stole from Koso in reference to a Dio Wong film, also produced by Wong Jing. So that's my semi-short opinion anyway. What do you think of From Vegas to Macau? You've seen it at least twice, prior and now for this viewing.
Yeah, well, I'm of two minds with this film. I'll defend it to a certain extent, and then my defense will be swiftly taken down. When I watched this in the cinema a year ago, just over a year ago, it was playing during Chinese New Year. This is a Chinese New Year film. In that context, in the cinema, with a full house, during Chinese New Year, this film was somewhat enjoyable. Normally, Chinese New Year films are given a slight pass because it's a holiday film, and because you expect them to be silly, you expect them to be campy, and you're looking for celebrities on screen. During that period of time when I watched it, I came out of the theater thinking, okay, you know, it is what it is, but I was happy to see Chow Yun-fat back doing a Chinese New Year film. You know, this wasn't his first his his return to Hong Kong film necessarily, because he had done The Last Tycoon, I think, a year or two earlier. But this was his return to a Chinese New Year film. And, you know, he's got quite a few films that he's done in his filmography that were Chinese New Year films. And I like seeing comedy Chow Yun-fat. I really enjoy him doing comedic roles. And for there are parts of this movie that I like, you know, where he's in it. But there are a lot of parts of this movie that are just out and out terrible. So taken in the context of watching this with a theater full of people, I had a good time with it. But on second viewing, by myself, at home, watching this thing, it was kind of arduous to get through. And so in that context, I don't think I could recommend this as a buy for somebody. You know, I wouldn't say go out and buy this, you know. If you are somebody who's a completionist, if you are somebody who's a Chow Yun-fat fan, if you're somebody who's looking for something to watch during Chinese New Year to sort of get you a little bit into the spirit, into the mood, then I might, you know, push this your way. But out of that context, it's a really bad film. It's bad in the way that, and we talked a little bit before about Wong Jing, and again, I like Wong Jing, but part of my dislike for Wong Jing movies of late is fully represented by this movie, in terms of if you compare this with the movie we started off with, right, the very first God of Gamblers, there's so much more lazy filmmaking here and so much more reliance on things that I would just call, I don't know, I don't want to say cheap, but things that just don't, they don't add anything to the film in ways that make me go back and watch God of Gamblers and still look at that as a movie that, you know, leaves me in awe at times. This is kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum.
And indeed, and you know, even the only way I would be able to relate to your context is if I had seen this with a Lunar New Year audience. You know, it might have been elevated, but even in that context, I love Lunar New Year movies, especially when Chow Yun-fat is out of his, you know, out of his mind, off his rocker in these kind of movies. Absolutely delightful, and that's like the sole delight of the movie, seeing him back in a Hong Kong movie acting very silly. And it's kind of thrilling to see Chow there in the opening credits in the flesh, because Wong Jing partly does a almost an opening to a TV show where the casts are introduced not only with their name in text, but they're actually there in the flesh as well. But he only does it for Chow Yun-fat, which is cool. Like, yeah, I like this. And then Nick Tse pops up. Yeah, he's pretty good. And then no one else pops up. So it's like, okay, only worth it to like show two of them. That's rather unfair. But there you go. I was already kind of annoyed at the beginning. And then shortly thereafter, there's Chapman Toe, who sports a haircut, first of all, that is part of an enjoyment I have with the triad movies is when they poke fun at the outrageous look of certain triads, especially those on the lower end of in the lower end of the rankings. They dress quite silly as well. But how would you describe for listeners how Chapman Toe's hairdo looks here? We are recording this during Easter, by the way. He partly looks like a chicken.
Yeah. A peep, maybe. Yeah, for those who know what peeps are. Yeah, it's kind of odd. And his overall role in total in this film is very odd. And we'll come back to I think a couple points that made me wonder if they just kind of threw him in because he was sort of the hot comedic talent. You know, he was in so many movies the past couple years. It's like he's the go-to guy for a comedy. Part of me feels that a lot of him, what he was doing was tacked on. But you mentioned the idea of him kind of having this sort of gangster look. The interesting thing is that if you look at very, very closely at the characters of Ben Zhui and Nick Tse as Cool, and then Chapman Toe as Carl, they describe themselves as Robin Hoods, basically. They're going around, they're not really gangsters, they're righting wrongs. And they have to do this because, again, this is a movie that's being primarily sold to China now. You know, so you can't have them being actual criminals, actual villains,
right,
and getting away with crime. So they have to put this kind of, well, that, you know, so this whole first thing that they're involved in, there's a method behind it. And you know, there's a thing that ends up happening, and they explain very succinctly why they're doing what they did, because the person they're doing it to is a really, really, really bad guy, right? So that in that case, the fact that they drive a taxi into a restaurant and, you know, are causing a lot of structural damage, which I'm guessing would anger the restaurant owner unless he was somehow in on the prank, you know, is kind of beside the point, right?
Do you think, by the way, I've heard this many times and I've not really picked up on what is awful, transparent pandering to mainland China. But like, hearing you talk about it and looking at this movie, the way they structure at least this little bit, this little scam, and why they're doing it, it's not embarrassing in terms of like how it's structured, what the twist is, that they're Robin Hoods. But you have seen a lot of these movies that are tailored off the mainland China censorship or what have you. Is this like okay in terms of how they wrote this and executed this, or is it like awfully transparent what they're doing?
Well, I do think it gets a little bit of a pass because it is a mainland film, but you know, very often you've got things like this where you expect a certain outcome if it's a mainland China movie, if it's intended for a mainland box office, and there can only be one outcome for bad guys. Perfect example of this: go watch Johnny To's Drug War, where they show you the outcome of the movie in the trailer, right? It's right there, because that's the only outcome that the movie can have. You know, going into a movie about a bad guy doing bad things, if it's going to play on the China market, is it SARFT or whoever the censor bureau is not going to let the bad guy get away with the crime, because that doesn't happen, right, according to their guidelines. So that's why you get, you know, if you have the special edition of Infernal Affairs, that's why you get the second ending where instead of you know, Andy Lau standing in the at the funeral site at the end, he exits the elevator and a guy walks up and slaps handcuffs on him, which of course makes no sense in the context of, you know, Infernal Affairs 3, but you know, there you have it. It's China friendly.
You know, because we have the bonus episode here, I don't care if we go off on tangents. I got to tell you the worst example of one of those added endings for different markets kind of thing. Like, rewind all the way back to 1982's Coolie Killer, Terry Tong's Coolie Killer, starring Charlie Chin. That has an ending where the main character is arrested, all right? It's actually on the main Maya DVD, but the actual video versions are a different, more looser, more open to interpretation kind of ending. The only thing is, the person that arrests Charlie Chin at the end of it, he dies early in the movie. You clearly see, like, it's Yu Hua. He clearly is lying dead in a field, like, 30 minutes early in the movie, and then he just shows up, like, hey, you're arrested now, the end.
This is his brother, twin brother, right?
Something like that. They don't even like, hey, you look like I'm his brother, and I'm also a cop. Like, you're arrested now. Shit. Yeah, it's a marvelous. So they've been doing a version of this, obviously, for a number of years.
The main thing is there are movies that work within these guidelines in a very clever manner and manage to do it in ways that are very, very entertaining and less obvious, I would say, than some of the examples we've cited. This film's by far not the worst. You know, one that comes to mind that's a good example of this is the movie Crazy Stone, if you've seen it, which is about, you know, it's a silly, you know, heist comedy, basically. So you know that the thieves can't get away with the crime, but the way that they kind of deal with them by the end is still very funny, very entertaining, and kind of leaves a little bit to the imagination, which is, you know, it shows a sign of good writing in my book.
Back to Chapman, who is awful in this movie, absolutely awful and just annoying as hell. But the thing is, I've followed Hong Kong cinema enough to like where I've seen Chapman To start out and then do movies for a couple of years and then challenge himself. He's fine in Infernal Affairs, but I like when he started to get material to work with, comedic material. You have Moonlight in Tokyo, which is both funny and dramatic, even quite violent. Very good movie with Leon Lai that we both don't like particularly much, but in that movie it works. And he was fine in Isabella many years ago, Pang Ho-cheong's drama. So there is that development, but when I'm looking at this, it seems like I'm guessing here, and you can correct me and give me like your view on Chapman To. It seems like he might get a little bit more sharper comedic material to work with occasionally, but also he's a go-to guy to just throw in there for quick and cheap laughs. For me, that grates, like, watching a movie like this is so grating, he's so loud and he's so unfunny, you want to strangle him. So it's, I'm hoping he's, like, developing somewhat into, like, more creative directions. But, like, what is, like, his trajectory, and what do you think of Chapman's trajectory yourself?
Well, I think he's gotten a bit of a bad rap over the last year, in part just because he's been in so many films. And a lot of what he ends up doing for many of these films is the typical Chapman shtick, which we're seeing here. But that being said, he does do some creative roles now and again. The ones you mentioned, I think, are good examples. One that I'd bring up, too, is Herman Yao's Love Lifting, where he plays a single father. It's not a comedic role, but it's not an overly dramatic role. You know, it's something where he's out of his element, but he does very well with the material he's given, and he shows that he's got a range that he can, you know, if the director is willing to give him the leash. But I think part of the problem is that he's a known comedic entity, and so they figure he's going to come in and do his thing, and he's going to bring in a certain amount of revenue based on what people expect. And so I don't think a lot of directors want him to break the mold that he's established for himself. But I do think he's tried. I mean, last year, probably one of the best examples of this is the Naked Ambition sequel. Not really a direct sequel, but 3D Naked Ambition, I think, is the actual title. And, you know, in that, he kind of got into shape. He buffed himself out. And he's playing a role through much of the film that's very, very different from other, you know, the normal Chapman character that he plays.
He's just loud and unfunny and starts, like, crying in the middle of scenes. And there's, like, a scene where he's starting to sing for no reason whatsoever, at least to me. Maybe it's a deeply thought out comedic bit, I don't know. But subsequently, he's punched out by Nicolas Tse. And I can't help to think, when two characters interact like that, how... And again, comparing is might be wrong, but we've been talking about Stephen Chow and Uman Tad. I just thought to myself, the two of them would have made a simple thing like that funny, because they are funnier. Chapman Tao normally to me isn't funny. Nick Tse is a good actor, not really a well-versed comedic performer, not yet anyway in my eyes. So it's one of those, like, it was the wrong performers to try and make this comedy flourish, like, I don't know, the old days, or flourish at all. But it's, and later he's crying, Chapman Tao, because he doesn't have, like, Chow Yun-fat's young wife or whatever. It's like, shut up, shut the hell up. Like, it's this, I guess that's it. I mean, I can ramble on forever, but it's annoying. That's the short opinion of it all.
It's very cartoonish, and I think it's there, again, they've kind of, my imagining would be they just kind of brought him in and had a very rough outline, and maybe he improved quite a few things, doing his normal stuff that he does, a little bit more over the top. I mean, some of the actual transitions that we get in the film itself are comic book panels, you know, so they are trying for a very cartoonish comic book kind of feel.
But only partly. I mean, there's no, like, through line towards that. It's like randomly Wong Jing throws that in. It's like, stick with one, like, stylistic theme rather than, like, oh yeah, we did that once, like 50 minutes earlier in the movie, do it again.
One thing that stood out for me was after this very first sequence, when we're introduced to Nick Tse and Chapman and Ben's characters, they get through to the sort of end sequence, and then the con that they're basically doing, and then there's this Japanese voice that comes on. And, you know, there's like these little spinning chip icons, and it basically, the translation is like, oh, let's see what just happened, right? Or how did they do it, you know? And it comes out in this sort of Japanese cutesy voice, but that's the only time they do that, you know? It's so he's got these cues in here that seem derived from other things, comic books, games, anime, whatever, that are not consistent throughout. So there's definitely an issue with consistency and pacing in this film.
Sure, being a Lunar New Year movie, they are, as far as I know, produced still fairly quickly. It's not one of those one-week quickies this, but because it has a little bit of budget behind it and it's and design and whatever. But still, they don't spend like a good year planning this meticulously or anything. It's I would imagine they shot this over like a little over a month or something like that. At least, you know, Chiang Fat is in this, and it's great to see him partly anyway back on the wacky side of things, you know, partly off the rails and kind of thing, because we don't meet Ko Chun here, we meet, you know, Ken, you know, Magic Ken. And when he meets Hoi Soo-hong's character, they have a little bit of a cheerful embrace and exchange and song and dance together. And I gotta tell you, it's not a Chiang Fat reference, wacky performance or anything, but there's enough here to confirm that he's a consummate pro that isn't phoning it in necessarily. And he is, when he pays on that great smile of his and acts silly, that's still quite infectious. Not laugh out loud funny, but I do like it. And it shows that Chiang Fat's touches to this kind of, when it comes to this kind of material, is still quite sharp. You know, if I wanted to see a great Lunar New Year performance, I'll go back to, you know, Ave Happiness or something like that. But it's good to see him back rather than being only in the mainland, only acting in English or acting seriously. It's good to see wacky Chiang Fat back.
Yeah, I'd agree. And it's nice. It's a nice moment between him and Ben Choi, you know, who's not a leading man per se, but a veteran character actor in Hong Kong cinema, who's got a lot of time under his belt, and I think I would have liked to have seen a lot more of the two of them on screen than perhaps Nick and Chapman on screen.
I gotta tell you, as much as I like Nick, when I think back on a movie, I don't know how much Nick even like does in this movie. He is second leading man, but he is more of a straight man aside from a moment or two. He definitely didn't make as much noise as obviously Chiang Fat or Chapman Toe. Is it kind of, you know, I like him to that extent where I would love to see him develop more. I mean, early in his career, he showed promise, you know, chief movies, among those being the Riley Ip movie, Matar de Fumaca, or however that you pronounce that Portuguese phrase. But that's a good, like, 17 years ago now.
I'm not a huge Nick Zay fan, I guess, with, you know, in terms of the whole sort of Gen X cops crowd who kind of came together there. I'm much more in the Stephen Fung camp. Of course, he's moved on to mostly behind the scenes in terms of producing and directing stuff now. So, and I'd like to see him more on screen, but I think he's pretty competent when it comes to behind the scenes work. So,
yeah, and again, it's a Lunar New Year movie. It's not to be expected that the biggest, like, meatiest dramatic part is given to Nick Tsai for a Lunar New Year movie. But the more I thought of it, it's like, I don't think he's in the movie that much. But that's because he may have played most of his scenes straight. But as much as I like Chiang Fat's role, it's no particular fun here seeing Chiang Fat back at the gambling table in a movie directed by Wong Jing. It's just like, I've seen that image before, and it's not really being taken to new levels here. It's no comfort factor seeing it again. And for me, it confirms my personal theory. Again, solely personal theories. I'm not dictating and preaching here. You know, Paula, people wish for actors and actor-director reunions that took place like a decade or two earlier, or 3 decades earlier. They want that again. They want a new comedy from a certain team. They want a new action movie from a certain team, whether it's John Woo and Chiang Fat, whether it's Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, and Yuen Biu. And my personal theory on it all is that it's not wise to wish for old cinema to be captured again, because that train has sailed on many levels. 30 years has passed. People have changed, cinematic landscapes have changed. So I would rather see, if there were to be like a Chiang Fat John Woo reunion, they should just like focus on doing a new good movie instead, rather than figuring out like a new way to tap into the commercialism of the 90s and 80s. You know what I mean? But I always want people to like move forward when they think of like these type of reunions, because you can't capture the magic in the bottle automatically by just putting them together again, especially not today.
Well, they keep trying, and that carries on again to the sequel of this film, which we're not going to get into today, but perhaps on a a later show.
Oh, you're on your own on that one.
But I think it's more of the what they're tapping into is the nostalgia that these kinds of films that we've been talking about up to this point, they don't make these kinds of films now. The tone, the style, the frantic pace, all of that's different. It's changed now. And I think there's still, a lot of the people who go out for these, when I see these films in the cinema, they're the older generation. They're the people who remember these movies, not the young kids as much. You know, they're the people who remember watching these movies and who think fondly on these movies. And so I think what's being tapped into, maybe in sort of a cheap fashion, is that sense of nostalgia that, Wong Jing and Chien Fat back together again. But then, of course, it leads to disappointment ultimately because they're not doing what they should be doing, which is, I think, what you are talking about. Again, it's very easy to be split on this film because, I love seeing Chien Fat up on the big screen doing a New Year movie, doing a Hong Kong movie for the most part, and still having it be kind of terrible is depressing at the same time. As with most Lunar New Year movies, there's things to like here. There's lots of cameos to look forward to.
Oh, you better speak of Michael Wong first, otherwise I will.
Well, no, I'm gonna take a pass on Mr. Wong first because I've got to mention Annie Wu, who plays his assistant, Chow Yun-fat's assistant, who looks fabulous. I mean, she looks gorgeous, and she's kind of been away from doing movies for a while. She's popped up in a couple things. I think she was in Pang Ho-chung's movie about the women taking over the world. Did you see that one? She came back and had a role in that and was pretty good, but we really haven't seen her do stuff. So it was nice to see her on screen, and of course there are some others that we'll mention passing. But yeah, Michael Wong, of course, here. And you mentioned his name is Inspector Lee. Yeah, that's not his name. His name should be Stone, okay? In any movie he's in, whether it's he's playing a modern movie or an old movie, his name has always got to be Stone, okay? Let's just get that correct.
Damn folks. Straight. But it was a nice surprise. I perked up like, hey, Michael is in this movie. Maybe it, like the train has not sailed for this movie yet. And he's even dubbing himself. Normally, yes. When Michael wasn't in sync sound back in the 90s, you'd had a fully Cantonese able performer dub him, sometimes really badly, because they like, for one of these cheap Category 3 movies that we've reviewed on This Week in Sleaze, you know how Michael sounds. They brought in a guy that sounds rough and like a man. But Michael's voice is lighter and is friendlier than that, rather than a brute. So, but he's dubbing himself, which leads into, again, it's minutia perhaps, but I'm quite surprised that why they chose to fully dub this rather than mix sync sound and dub where it needed to be dubbed, i.e. for presumably the Mandarin speaking performers. Because we have a fully dubbed movie, Chien Fat dubs himself, presumably Chapman Toe, Nick Tse, Benz Hoy does as well, Michael, as I said. It doesn't truly bother me, but I would love for it to be more of a mixture where, for instance, where you have a scene or five in a row with all Cantonese speaking performers, shoot it in sync sound. And even if you had a performer in the midst of all this, like the rooftop sequence where Michael Wong and the lady cop, I forgot her name, are trying to recruit him, even if they dubbed her in the midst of all that speaking Cantonese, I wouldn't be bothered at all having a live element and a dubbed element, especially today, because sync sound is finally, after many years, a more standardized thing. Or has it actually gone back to being a rarity in Hong Kong mainland cinema?
It's still a rarity because, well, you get these mixed casts like this movie, and so you end up going, they end up either doing post dubbing for one direction or the other. And I've always been an advocate for sync sound, and I'm always an advocate, even if you've got a mixed cast, let them act, right? Let her do her lines in Mandarin so we hear her voice. You know, this goes on all the time. People speak Mandarin and Cantonese and channel switch back and forth. So let these people do it, do their lines naturally and let them act. Don't bring in, you know, but of course, that's not the way they do things here. And I'm still a minority when it comes to my desires for pure sync sound where...
Because they know it. They know it now. I mean, in the 90s, I think they the maybe skill wasn't there to record good sound based on the fact that they were shooting in Hong Kong and all the noise and what have you. But they surely have technicians that know their way around shooting sync sound nowadays. I mean, it's such a modern industry, you know, whether working with crew in Hong Kong or in the mainland.
Yeah, I think that I can understand in the older films where they would do post-dubbing track for Cantonese because you had to do the Mandarin one at the same time. And Hong Kong's a busy city. You get a lot of exterior noise, things you can't control, especially when you're on that fast, frenetic shooting schedule. And, you know, you guys were talking on a previous show for the director's series with the David Chang, Eric Tsang movie, I think Heaven Can Wait or Heaven Can Help. And I think you brought up the point that it wasn't Eric Tsang doing his voice, but it kind of worked for the role. And you get this a lot. You get, you know, occasionally you'll get movies where it's actually like Andy Lau's voice, but a lot of times it's not. They would have a go-to guy. And so you get this disconnect a lot. But I think in today's movies, you don't need to do this anymore, you know. And I've always been a proponent of, again, letting the actors act. And I think there are quite a number of good films you can point to where they do this, where they have one actor speaking Mandarin and another actor speaking Cantonese, and it's just assumed they understand each other. And the dialogue sounds clear and natural, and it flows well.
Yeah, go back. Okay, it's effing 15 years ago now, or whatever. But go back to Shaolin Soccer, like Stephen Chow speaking Cantonese to Vicky Chow, and they made no fuss about it. It was not like, "Wah, I can't understand you. Where are you from?" It's just she spoke Mandarin, and that's that. And I believe both were in sync sound, rather than like them shaping it afterwards. But regardless, it was like a Cantonese and Mandarin exchange. And I think he even did it for Kung Fu Hustle, possibly. It's an action movie, partly, this as well. Apparently, Philip Lionel, playing like the undercover thing there, has a fight or two, for instance, versus all the guards of the DOA tower. And here's an aspect that fails too. The action is not shot very well, which is par for the course when it comes to modern movies, unfortunately. It's way too tightly framed. The camera work is sloppy and shaky. And the editing is way too frantic. I've seen worse, but the editing is still too frantic. There's no immersion in the action when you wince looking at it like, ooh, I can't, like, oh, that's like literally creating a headache when watching it. I'm not asking for everything to be like a Lau Kar-leung shot scene from the 70s or anything, but show me some clarity and some extended takes of action, because clearly the design of action in this movie and the performers here are able to do this. So I think it's a sign of modern times, the way you gotta catch modern audiences by being this quick cut. And I think that's absolutely sad. But I'm an old fart that likes his things a certain way. I have plenty of things to catch up on during the olden times, and I don't need to worry too much about modern cinema, but it's kind of sad when you clearly see talent on display here that isn't showcased very well.
The shoehorning in of the Lionel role in and of itself is kind of problematic. I mean, the fact that he's there to do action, and Philip is a very... very, very good action persona, I would say. I mean, go look at Once Upon a Time in Shanghai, also from last year, and he's really amazing in that film. Mm-hmm. But here, I mean, yeah, he's the half-brother of Nick Tse somehow. They never really get into the explanation of it, so I guess their mom is the same. There's this thing where their mom is in Dongguan with cancer, going through cancer treatment. So Ben's is their dad, but I don't know, is he like the stepdad, or the mom is their mom but from different fathers? So Ben's is like Nick's. It's just weird the way they kind of set this up, and they could have just made it much, okay, he's my brother, you know, that's it, that's all there is to it. He's not my half brother, some weird kind of thing. Yeah, and aside from the physical action, which we do get sort of there in the beginning, we get a lot of CG action, which is just such a letdown. Especially towards the end.
Yeah, you'd think this was a 3D movie, Paul, but they didn't shoot From Vegas to Macau in 3D until the second.
But there's a lot of the flying deadly cards thing, and this is the technique of Magic Hand Ken, or Chow Yun-fat's character, which we've seen and we've discussed already. It was used in one instance by the antagonist in God of Gamblers, The Return. And I think we talked about, wasn't this kind of established with Leon Lai in City Hunter?
They had like some gunfire and stuff in the hallways with the terrorists, and Leon Lai indeed had some card skills on that note. Yeah, way more funnier in those movies.
But here it's really over the top. Even the gambling, and I think you talked about seeing Chow Yun-fat at the gambling table, just wasn't sparking the same the same kind of passion that had been coming up in the previous movies for us. Part of it for me was I really had no idea what was going on here. The first game they're playing, it's like it uses a bunch of cards and they have to make entire suits out of a deck or something. And it's basically Chow Yun-fat and Patrick Kung comes in for a cameo as this mouthy guy. And then Chapman Toe is there as kind of the third. The way that it works out is that I guess Chapman Toe ends up winning the hand. I had no idea what was going on, though, there. So that one lost me. And then later, when he's facing off with the true antagonist of the film, I think they're doing Baccarat, which is also another game where I really have no idea of how that game is played. I know it's a popular game, apparently, in Macau, because I think it's been featured in a couple movies where Macau is kind of the central location. I just really had no idea. But when they sit down and the two of them are kind of showing off, it's all like there's one shot of a close-up of hands of like a traditional sort of card shuffle that you can see is a real kind of tricky shuffle. But then it goes into guys flipping things in the air, and it's almost like a circus roller coaster of CG. And it just looks kind of terrible.
Who's impressed by that? Like, the cards are flying like they're insects all over the table. And it's like, never mind the CG, like the just concept of them just controlling these cards magically. Like, so what? I don't care about that. Play fucking cards, man.
You know, you can, if you go back and look at a couple of the films we've talked about already, I think in was it Back to Shanghai or in maybe All for the Winner, they're pulling out the cards and you kind of know it's cards on strings, but that looked practical and it looked real and it looked like, okay, it's an effect, but it's there. It's not this sort of, green screen thrown in kind of thing. Practical or CG effects are great when they look good, but they just don't look that good here. So between that, between the what we get at the table and between what we get when Chow Yun-fat's like flicking all these things and having them, embed themselves in people's heads and stuff, it's a bit too much CG for me.
It's a cartoony side to the movie, and the comedy takes a cartoony turn right out of effing nowhere. Well, and I guess Chapman Toe at one point freaks out because he won something, like a game of cards and what have you, and they're at home with Chow Yun-fat. So all of a sudden, it looks like he gets injected with some serious drugs and goes and turns into a cartoon character. I don't know how else to explain it. You can have your take on it. I can't explain what he does, but he has this massive, not massive, but like frantic rant as a cartoon character all of a sudden, where he says, "I love Wong Jing. I love him. I urge him to make films into his 90s. But he's got a pot belly and he's fat." And it all comes out of nowhere. Like someone just wound up a toy for an hour and then it just went like, what's going on there? And it's obviously a big CG scene as well. It really looks like this was bound to be 3D because you have like cartoon eyes popping out of him and crap like that. And it's again Wong Jing's like, I'm gonna reference myself and have Chapman Toe call me fat, ha ha ha. It's Wong Jing's weakness even in the 80s and 90s, where you just say that is per definition comedy. But we don't have any comedic performers to say it and sell it. Well, say it anyway, because I'm wondering. I don't know. It certainly is rare in the movie here, the frantic comedy. But so it pops up right out of nowhere. For the 10 seconds that it lasts, that whole cartoon character Chapman Toe, it's like, wow, that was semi-amusing that he became all Japanese all of a sudden.
And it's just, it's in some cases, it's set pieces like that thrown together with this overall plot with this bionic eye. The whole reason to get sort of the character of Magic Hand Ken into this whole thing is is kind of nonsense in and of itself. So basically, they're trying to trap this guy, Ko, and in order to do that, because they've lost their inside man now, they want Chow Yun-Fat to go and challenge him because he's got a big ego and basically get under his skin and make him upset so that he slips up. If this is not the worst police tactical plot I've ever heard, I don't know what is, because it's just so far outside of the realm of possibility. You know, you've got this international team of Macau police, Hong Kong police, and mainland China police, and they're going to come to this gambler and say, yeah, go gamble with this guy and make him mad, because then we're going to be able to catch him.
And speaking of police, apparently Magic Ken also has a magic mouth. He is on the yes. level of Michael Winslow from Police Academy, because Chow Yun-Fat can, with his mouth, do the sound of gunfire, which Chow Yun-Fat can't do, which Michael Winslow can do, the comedian Michael Winslow. And that was also right out of nowhere. Like, okay, magic mouth it is for a couple of seconds. Almost this on-the-spot kind of concept that they came up with during a gunfight. And it's not very clever, because, I don't need crazy elements to be telegraphed or anything, but it's not working for me. It isn't. Despite it being Chow Yun-Fat that's been given the Michael Winslow spirit for a few seconds.
It might have been good if they, you know, had a guy who could actually perform like Michael Winslow as, you know, an assistant who just hangs around him
yeah.
and can do that when needed, instead of just, you know, because it's so obviously sound effects that you're hearing, and it doesn't even seem to fit in the realm of what he can do with his mouth, even if it's augmented somehow. So it's not something that works very well. And it's something they go to, I think, at a later point in the film as well, as a plot device. And just, you add to that the bungee jumping around the home, because every girl likes the bungee jump around their very high-ceilinged home. Yeah, because that's what you just do, right?
That's what Lara Croft did, at least in that movie from many, many years ago. It's like, we got a reference to some old craft that the kids don't know anything about. But, dude, you know, thank God, Paul, by the way, the movie refrained from being a two-hour endeavor.
Yes, indeed.
It's 90 minutes, so it's not painfully slow or anything, but if it had been 2 hours, Paul, tedium would have set in, because imagine the filler that Wong Jing would come up with to get this to 2 hours. But yeah, the first gambling movie that's this short.
But even as short as it is, a lot of the stuff, and, you know, to go back to one of my earlier points of disappointment with this film, is repetition. It's stuff that's been done before, sometimes better in other films. So, for example, we get the giant card gag, right? I've seen that before. I can't pinpoint the film. But, you know, it's like, oh, there's nothing bigger than an ace. Oh, here's a bigger ace, you know. It's like, all right, I think I've seen that in a Hollywood movie.
And then Chow Yun-Fat's laugh in the second shot after that.
Yeah.
What's that about?
They were just pushing it back to the cartoony nature of it, I think.
Pardon me, you know how that would have been funny? I'm sorry to echo like Stephen Chow and Umatat. Stephen Chow pulling out the big card and Umatat just falling over. Wah! That would have been funny. I mean, I can make you laugh just saying that. You know exactly what I mean. Like, it would have had the right kind of energy there. Again, I'm sorry to compare, you know, comedic performance to the performance here, but that's what I was thinking throughout the movie. That would have been funnier in 1990 or 91, but hey, there it is.
Yeah, we also get a truth serum that also somehow works as a Spanish fly, right? So it's two in one. And that's, of course, what every secret agent or bad guy needs. And so then, of course, we get this, again, this overused sequence where, of course, it's been given to the unfortunate mainland police officer who's being driven home and rescued by Chow Yun-Fat, a much, much, much older man. I think at one point she says, oh, I'm 18, so it's okay. Oh, I hope she's over 18 if she's representing the mainland police force on an international level. Yeah. So it's the whole, I'm feeling frisky time now. And so, you know, I want you kind of effect that we've seen done time and time again in lots of Wong Jing movies. Then by the time we've got this big sort of event happening, being put on by the antagonist. One of the twists of that event is also being pulled right out of the con man movies. The interesting thing is that was done in the con man movies, if I recall correctly, by Nick Chung. So there's a whole green screen thing that they do with a soccer match, and Nick Chung is,
which is the best joke in this movie. But are they reusing that?
That's a redo.
Oh, from, man.
I don't remember if it was the second or the first con man movie, but it's pulled right from that whole con.
Wow.
But it's interesting that, okay, so you've got Chapman doing the Nick Chung con from Con Man, but then Nick Chung is actually in the sequel to this movie. So there's some weird kind of incestuousness going on here across films. But also, too, the thing, you know, the international waters and secretly sailing the boat back within waters. We've seen that in this series as well. So coming back to that, we get a, you know, what is the Mission Impossible style face-off moment, too. Kind of comes from out of nowhere, but you know.
it's almost like old-timey swordplay movie as well, where all the bad guys, it's not a bad guy in this case, but the bad guy is like having this perfect face-off style mask, you know, which but again, it comes out of nowhere, and it's not charming when it does appear here. It doesn't bring energy and fun to the proceedings. I mean, the whole gunplay kung fu ending, it has decent energy, but it's just, as you said, a lot of dull CG fakery, which just negates it. You don't get like excited to see Chiang Fat back in action because an over reliance on this, trying to impress the general audiences. But I might not be general audiences, so fair enough. But I was not impressed at all with the whole ending, and despite it not being a gambling finale per se, it's not elevating itself through the movie, and it never reaches a crescendo. I did enjoy when it all is revealed how they all did it. We've gone through the modern trickery of 1989 with X-ray glasses and things like that to robotic implants in 2014 to like be the best at cards and to see through the bad guy and to ultimately win. Kind of enjoyed how far they went with that in terms of Chiang's character.
Yeah, I think that it was an interesting throwback to the tech of the first film, which we've talked about. And then you get, you know, it's a fight scene that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me at the end between Nick Tse. And so there's the antagonist has this young kid who's a martial arts expert, you know, who ends up getting in a fight with Nick Tse, and it seems to be constantly handing Nick Tse's butt to him. But then, of course, Nick Tse gets the upper hand and comes out on top at the end. But even that is not as... It just doesn't hold that same level of energy or level of excitement that you were talking about.
And it's also not very well shot either. It's clearly the choreography is onto something, but then the camera language and the editing just takes you out of the flow. You know, someone said once that, and it's so true, that you don't notice consciously when something is flowing, but you so notice it consciously when it isn't. And it stands out like a sore thumb. Here it is. You know, when you watch a great fight scene from, again, back in the day, if we're going back, it's just enjoyable to be in it rather than sitting there, ooh, nice camera shot, you know, ooh, good editing. You don't do that. You just go with the flow. Here there's no flow. So there we are. Hey, I'm going to spoil a big thing because I don't care. Ko Chun appears in this movie. Dawson, the god of gamblers himself. I don't care because it matters to even less degree than some things in this movie. It's a tacked on Lunar New Year celebration type of scene where everybody gets their red packets and in walks Ko Chun, giant fat ass Ko Chun. I gotta tell you, Paul, I went so what to that as well. Like, that wasn't needed to elevate this experience and to get a wah moment towards the end. It was just desperation. A little bit of desperation.
Yeah, it's, and I don't want to spoil it, but this desperation continues into the sequel as well when they end the sequel with a similar mechanism. It's almost worth watching the movie for, but not entirely.
So some minor just random notes, and I'm done with this. I enjoy the little the first scene of Chiang Fat's and Hoi Si Hung and Nick Tse and Chapman Toh meeting him. It's at his birthday banquet, and they have a big birthday lottery. And one of the guys wins a golden toilet filled with chocolate bars, which I thought was a lovely piece of production design, to be honest, because they opened that thing up and it's like, oh, what's that? That's chocolate. That was a good, like, throwback to the fact that, hey, chocolate. I gotcha, Wong Jing. And actually, it's obviously not gold in actuality by the production design team, but it actually is a lovely piece, actually. And in Chai Fat's mansion, he has a lot of countermeasures whenever his security system is triggered. They are quite well realized on screen, I thought, even when there's CG involved. Some things look physical, like the bear traps coming out of the floors and catching the people trying to break in and assassinate whoever. But the big CG moment where it's revealed that under the floor is a big cannon. I thought that was well played and timed. And as a matter of fact, it's a water cannon that has quite a lot of pressure behind it, though. But I thought that was a good usage of CG fakery. And we've talked about out of the blue elements not working. I thought this was an out of blue element that did work.
Yeah, I'd agree. One of the things that they establish about this character is that he's a trickster. He's not a skilled gambler by any means, like Ko-chan. So he's a very different character from Ko-chan, which I think is refreshing. And I wouldn't mind seeing this more of this character if there were a good script written around him, you know what I'm saying? Because I think that Chow Yun-fat as this trickster character is fine. It's just that the material that we're given is kind of tired and old hat, and we really need to see much more newness with him. And unfortunately, we haven't gotten a lot of that.
The only funny Chapman Toe scene, by the way, when we see his freaky chest hair. When he pops out of the pool, and his chest hair is all around the nipple area, and there's a big bush of that. And at one point, someone pulls his nipples, it's a big CG thing, and it's so disgusting that all the beautiful girls at that pool party pukes, which is still funny. I actually thought when they go that extreme and that cartoony, that just add to that. But again, Wong Jing isn't seeking out to make a big old alive cartoon. It's just random ideas thrown in that are more frantic and more cartoony than some of the verbal stuff, the verbal banter. But it's the sole image of Chapman Toe that kind of took me by surprise, where I had a good little laugh. And not a fright, but a little laugh.
There's also a big hole with Chapman Toe in part of the film where right before the characters are coming to, multiple thugs are coming to invade Chow Yun-fat's home, he's like sitting outside in a tent, right? And so there's this scene where like you see him sticking his head outside the tent and what looks like flashlights, and he's like saying, oh, who's that? Who's there? And then he's just gone for like a long period. And then he shows up again as to, you know, with no real discussion of like, all right, what was that scene? You know, what was that happened before? It's just like, you know, there's some pacing moments. There's some transitions that don't fully work. But for me, the best moments are Chow Yun-fat being Chow Yun-fat and funny. And especially with some of the, like the scenes with Ben's Hui, he has a funny scene where Ben's is in the hospital. You know, and he goes in and he's talking to him, and he's like on the oxygen, you know, on the oxygen tube, and Ben's can't breathe. And, you know, you've seen that kind of thing before, but the two of them sell it. I think I laughed in that scene. Maria Cordero shows up for a cameo in a funny sequence with him. And again, two veterans, seeing them on screen, you know, poking fun. And that's right before, of course, Michael Wong shows up. And, you know, Michael Wong can do no wrong, so.
It's been a while since they were in a movie together. I'd like to say Treasure Hunt? Was Michael Wong in that? It might have been. So it's not the most usual sight of Chow Yun-fat and Michael Wong on screen. But I seem to remember, I think that was a Lunar New Year movie in 1994 that was quite enjoyable. Chow Yun-fat and Wu Qianlian, and don't need to look it up now, just treasure the fact that Michael Wong still looks amazing. And seeing him next to Chow Yun-fat is quite enjoyable. And as you said, the Maria Cordero cameo, good on her, by the way, because it's set up as, oh, I'm going to meet my old girlfriend. Look at how beautiful she looked. And she turns out to look like Maria Cordero, who's fat and crap. Maria Cordero's game and an energetic performer, and I always like seeing her on screen as well. So it was a nice little bit for two performers to be very silly. Have no idea why they were singing back and forth with each other, though. Did you understand that gag, or was that too local for even you?
Because I'm not a big music guy. I know that, you know, she's got tons of albums, and she may have actually sung something with him before, so it could be some reference to that. It's probably a reference to a song of hers.
All right, my notes are over. They're done and dealt with. I have no interest in watching the sequel. If we do it on the Dynasty Report, you're on your own. This was, and I've heard the sequel is not one notch more awful, but on another level awful. That's the impression I get from hearing you sigh just thinking of the sequel.
Yeah, it's
in 3D. any other notes you want to share before we move on?
Yeah, no, I just say this is one not one to end your gambling season on. So
that is the, oh, by the way, as for availability, this has both available local DVD and Blu-ray releases in Hong Kong. Both are English subtitled. The Blu-ray is probably region coded for Hong Kong. So if you don't have a region-free Blu-ray player, then the DVD surely will suffice. But it's out there available. Don't think there's a Western distributor as of yet. And that's not probably happening anytime soon, because this is not a Hong Kong action movie that is going on export or anything. I think it's going to be kept within the confines of Asia, if you will.
Yeah, unfortunately, the DVD is region coded, though. It is a region 3. So if you are at least in the States and looking to get a hold of this, you're probably going to want to go with the Blu-ray, which will be region A, which does play in the U.S.
Oh, it does. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is the bonus section on From Vegas to Macau. Done. And I wanted it here in the bonus format to add the final piece of context of how the gambling action comedy worked then versus now. So it was not like I was expecting a masterpiece, but I thought I'd pick this because it's Wong Jing, Chai Fat, and we can kind of have a good old discussion and not a moan about how it plays then versus now. But remember, kids, I said we had a special surprise for you at the halfway point. I don't know if it's special to me anyway. So we're not done with gambling season. We still got one more review to do. And after the musical break, you'll hear me and Paul discuss The Top Bet from 1991, which is the sequel to the Stephen Chow comedy All for the Winner. And we'll try to sort out the laundry again of how it all fits. So join us after a break for the final review during gambling season, The Top Bet. And the only reason I included it is because I liked it, and a few people said that, hey, what about The Top Bet? That was enough reason for me to arrange for it to be the special surprise of gambling season. So check it out after the break. Welcome back, and indeed a special surprise is our review of The Top Bet, going back to 1991, and plot from the Love HK film review of the film. Shortly after tramping evil bastard Hong, played by Paul Chun in the previous film, All for the Winner, Sing, Stephen Chow in a bookended cameo, decides to take time off to travel the world. However, Triad Chun, the film's co-director Jeff Lau, reprising his role from the first film and looking into the ceiling in almost each and every scene, isn't about to go quietly into gambling obscurity, and he re-ups with a super king of gambling competition. And after backing Sing in the first film, he wants him to participate again, naturally. However, as mentioned in that opening sequence, there is no Sing, meaning Uncle Tat, played by Uman Tat, and he finds his balls in a vice grip. And luckily, Tat has not one, but two options for Singh's gambling replacement. First up is Mei, played by Anita Moy, who just happens to be Singh's sister. Mei has been sent by the mainland to clean up Singh's disgrace because he used his psychic powers for money, which is bad. And she is leery of helping out Tat, but finds her own reasons for sticking around Hong Kong anyway. Meanwhile, Tat looks to recruit the queen of gambling, which is fishmonger Fanny, played by Carol Dodo Sheng. She purports to be a master of gambling, but is really nothing more than a cheap grifter or a sharper in gambling parlance. The two girls go head-to-head with their powers. Fanny pretends to have them, and May tries to make Fanny look bad. Fanny wants the window to help out her wheelchair-bound brother, and May is hot for a two-bit thief, played by Kenny B, not me, in an overacting dopey performance. As you'd expect, they'll join forces to do the evil guy in and make time for the settlement of their personal conflicts. So that's Coastal's major plot. And I'll take the reins again, a quick opinion. A lot of fun, even without Stephen Chow. And it shows it's also the filmmakers, Jeff Lau and Corey Yun, knowing comedic instincts themselves rather than relying on a performer. And they transfer this wacky Mole Town nature to the new performance really, really well. So that's my short opinion. What did you think of The Top Bet? And I gather this is a rewatch for you.
Oh, yeah. This is I've seen this many times. It's one of my favorite Hong Kong films, definitely, you know, in this series and perhaps of all Hong Kong films. I just, I've always loved it. It sticks out in my mind primarily because of the cast, more so than, you know, the place that it has in the sequence of the films. But yeah, it's just a fun piece of filmmaking. And it's one that I'm very glad we're ending on rather than the one we just talked about.
Yeah, I wanted to keep the main series short, so I never like forgot about The Top Bet or anything, but I thought like we can't go on forever because then we might be here forever. First of all, drawing upon memory, explain the Stephen Chow cameo and how this movie ties together with All for the Winner, because it can get complicated when trying to like connect the sequels and the spin-offs and what have you. So the floor is yours.
Right, so this is in fact a true sequel to All for the Winner, even though we've got, and we've already talked about, God of Gamblers 2, which is in essence a sequel to this in terms of, I guess, time period, right? So here, this film actually picks up in the finale of All for the Winner, and we get to see that finale over again, and we get to see some extended footage here. And so this sets up the first of the bookends that Ken mentioned, where we've got Stephen Chow basically in the gambling hall with Man Tat. They've won, and now he's basically saying, I think I want to travel and see the world, so you kind of stay here for a bit. Primarily, I'm sure he's very busy at this point. This film comes out just a few months after God of Gamblers 2. So you'll remember we talked about the timing and the spacing between the filming, the release of All for the Winner, and then the few months they had to film God of Gamblers 2 and then release that late in the year of 1990. And so this comes out in March of 91. And so it's even just a few months after God of Gamblers 2. But technically it is set before the events of that film.
And there's no doubt that this is new footage with Stephen Chow. They brought him in for two new scenes rather than like shooting them for All for the Winner. And, you know, good on him for being a good sport and workhorse to support a movie that had plenty of talent like cast already. But because I don't think this is a desperate move on the filmmaker's part. It's commercial. Yes, you can kind of promote that Stephen Chow is in this movie, but it's got plenty of stars already. So I think it's admirable that Stephen Chow came out to do a quick cameo to tie the movies together. Because as we know, the 90s, he was already busy. The 90s were busy in general, but he was already busy. And I'm sure he got paid as much as he wanted to appear for a little bit. But still, it's a very welcome and admirable move, I think, for the movie. It doesn't like negate its purpose by like shoehorning in a cameo, because I don't think it is shoehorned in. I think it's funny.
And it's nice, too, that one of the things that this film does was a point of criticism I kind of had for God of Gamblers 2, in that it brings back some of the supporting cast from All for the Winner. So we get to see a little bit of an update with, for example, Sandra Ng's character, Corey Yun's character, and Jeff Lau's character, some of the others who were much more prominent but then didn't show up in the direct sequel that we got a few months before this film. So it's nice to see that sort of continue on, even though we're given central characters to sort of take up the focus. But I guess one of the main things that we can kind of look at with this film is that we now get Man Tat as a standalone. He not working as sort of the funny man or the sidekick to Stephen Chow here, he's kind of cast out there on his own, and I think he works, you know, equally well here.
I think
with,
so, yeah.
With the two ladies and the stuff that he's given.
It's funny, though, a little detail in the story and the context and what have you. Singh obviously has high aspirations to learn of the world and gambling, but when we reach God of Gamblers 2, it seems like Uncle Tat is just keeping him home and not having him do anything because he doesn't know really anything. I always said that he has a kid-like demeanor about him, even mentally. So it's one of those, like, hey, you mentioned our performers. I mentioned Carol Dodo Sheng. Do you think this movie wanted to not write, but echo and do some hopefully creative comedy bits using the whole Her Fatal Ways angle? And I know they didn't cast Carol Cheng in a similar role from Her Fatal Ways, but we have Anita Moy in that coming from the mainland character. So do you think Her Fatal Ways has any inspiration on this production at all?
Well, yeah, it's again going a little bit back to the point we talked about with Stephen Chow's character, with Anita Moy coming in as the bumpkin mainlander who, you know, is a bit naive and who's fascinated by some aspects of, you know, Hong Kong modernity. She's not stupid because, again, there's this great back and forth between her and Carol Cheng, where Carol Cheng is basically the card shark, right? Whereas Anita Moy actually has the skills. So these two are kind of parallels between the Stephen Chow and Andy Lau character in some sense from God of Gamblers 2. But of course, Carol Cheng is, you know, she's constantly at odds and trying to stay one step ahead with her, you know, with her deceptions. And Anita calls her on it, you know, even though she seems naive, she's not a simpleton. She recognizes a scam when there's a scam going on. Yeah. And so that sets up a lot of the really great sort of back and forth that still makes me smile today, even, you know, just kind of thinking about it. And to talk a little bit about Carol Cheng, because I think people who've heard us before know I'm a huge fan of Anita, and that's one of my big reasons for my love for this particular film. And I've mentioned it before. I know we did back on episode 177, we talked, you know, we had a special on her where we talked about Heroic Trio and Justice My Foot. And Anita's got a good range here. You know, she brings just to her body language, the way she kind of like hops along, you know, it's so very different from things she's done, you know, in other roles. And so she brings a nice characterization. But Carol Cheng, this woman for me, I thought she was just gorgeous in the 80s and 90s. And I know she's got, you know, she's got that kind of mom next door look. And that just really worked for me. And I think Anita's gorgeous too. But Carol Cheng, you know, I guess a lot of people would look at her and go, oh, no, she's just kind of a plain Jane type. But she was really my type. And, you know, when I first saw her, I think in the Hearts to Hearts series in 1988, you know, I was like, wow, this is the kind of girl I like.
You never expected necessarily the comedian to pop out of that, because you're very right. You see her, and then she would be suited for many type of roles, but comedy, and quite broad comedy too, as you'll probably mention with Her Fatal Ways, it's quite a broad role. It really was her forte. It was never a forced image on Carol Cheng.
She's done really good dramatic roles as well, so she's got a really good range. It's just so tragic what has happened to her, if you've kept up with her, because she's unfortunately gone through some very bad plastic surgery.
Oh no!
At some point, and you know, you don't see her do a lot of film roles anymore. I think the last film she did was, I want to say, Happy Family, some years back, but I could be wrong on that. But yeah, she doesn't do film now, and primarily she's doing TVB hosting, pretty much all the time on different variety shows and things. But she looks like a completely different person. She's like super skinny, almost anorexically so. And she's just, she wears her hair differently now. She's got super heavy makeup and her face is kind of all kind of pulled tight. And she just doesn't look the same anymore. I mean, I remember the first time I saw her and somebody, you know, pointed out that, oh, that's Carol Cheng. I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And yeah, it's apparently, you know, that she had either one too many or she had one particular bad job done. She just looks very, very different now.
I can just see in front of me, if she had not done that, she would have aged with like perfect grace.
You know,
I even saw images of Joey Wong recently that suggested that she'd gone under the knife as well. And
yeah, that's a big issue in the news here too as well.
So, but by the way, what does the Dodo come from? Because she's sometimes referred to as Carol Dodo Cheng. It's not part of a Chinese name. It's a sort of a nickname kind of thing. But I never know where that came from.
I don't know. Dodo is just what everybody calls her. Dodo Jie.
Does it mean anything when combined with Dodo Jie?
It might be from an earlier role that she got famous for, like a TVB role in a TV drama. But I never have figured out that particular nugget. No.
And her trademark role obviously became through four movies shot in Sing Sound. Nonetheless, we talked of Sing Sound nowadays not being utilized. When Her Fatal Ways, the series that Alfred Cheung directed, was shot, all movies were Sing Sound. So you got Carol Cheng as the, I suppose, stern, loyal to the mainland police officer coming to Hong Kong and trying to, I don't know, not adjust necessarily because she's a proud mainlander, but eventually she does. And they're very funny comedies, not very insensitive necessarily, maybe in some areas, side areas. But I always thought that thanks to her and obviously the director and writing team, it was a good characterization that could have gone very wrong. But they handle it very well as she comes to Hong Kong and tries to, be superb, I suppose, versus the Hong Kongers, because I don't think her character initially likes them very much because she's a mainlander. Yeah, they're all good fun. Even the fourth one, I remember, was good because they kept the Sing Sound going for the fourth one even, and they cast Gregory Charles River in that movie, speaking both English and Chinese. And what a wonderful thing to have, like, natural, alive dialogue, because it's a joke, obviously, that she doesn't know that he understands her and all of that, and all of a sudden, he reveals that he does, and he can speak seemingly perfect Chinese, not Michael Wong Cantonese or anything, but seemingly more sharper. So very much recommended. I love the second one a lot, Her Fatal Ways too, but all are very much recommended, and use language appropriately, because the third one is set in partly in Taiwan, so you got Mandarin Sing Sound for that, and it's all good. It never gets old, by the way, to see Uman Tat involuntary hump stuff.
Yeah.
When Uncle Tat is mentioned, it's a gag that just works, because Uman Tat does that noise, but he doesn't just hump things, because Anita Moy does it to him twice, and the second time he has an ice cream cone in his hand. When she says the key word, so to say, he starts rubbing the ice cream all over his face, in a kind of thing that you hope that they didn't do like 20 takes of that. Because he does it, obviously, with a real ice cream cone. So it never gets old. It's all good fun. And Uman Tat is not out of his element just because Stephen Chow is not beside him, as you very well pointed out. The entire movie has great wit and energy. Gags like, I won't quote too many gags, but an initial gag where Anita Moy meeting Jeff Lau's character, who stares at the ceiling. What was that, a trait where that signals that he's not trustworthy, only like way comically over the top for this movie? Was that it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I think this was a point maybe when in a Stephen Chow movie or another movie where they talk about the antagonist doesn't look people in the eye, and so you know he's not a good guy.
So he's just looking in the ceiling, and like when there's commotion in the room, he's like asking, "What's going on? Can anyone tell me what's going on?" Because he's smoking and he's looking up at the ceiling. So that's your co-director Jeff Lau in the movie here again. But the gag here where Anita Moy, it's kind of her first scene in Hong Kong. She arrives at this table and sort of faces off against Jeff Lau. And you see the table starts to shake, like, oh my God, her powers. And then in editing, a gag is created where you see a full shot of the table and Anita Moy just shaking it. Shaking the table by herself, which you'd think like, oh, she has no powers, she just chooses, you know, when to use it, because as you also said, she's not dumb. And it's one of those, if you create it in editing and don't make a fuss about it, like, no one says, oh my God, she's shaking the table, that's crazy. No, they don't. They just do it in shots in editing, and it's perfect timing. That's Anita Moy being very well on board, because I don't remember too many movies before this if she was a tested comedian or not, but obviously subsequently there was no area where I felt Anita Moy had lacking skills. You know, she always showed up comedically, certainly dramatically, and it's always enjoyable to watch back. And it's the immortal celluloid of now sadly deceased woman that's there. You know, it's not dated at all either, which is wonderful. And the character is quite unique, as you also said, because she's not a dummy at all. And the funny angle of this whole universe is that there is a magic power society that she belongs to, and she's sent to and they police essentially their performers because they know that Sting has not used his powers for good. So it's a funny aspect of the universe that there is organizations that cover these things. So and that brings a Junhua cameo to the movie as well in a few scenes. So
yeah, and it also makes me wonder too if this is the same organization that Tai Kun and his fellows come from when we get them by extension to the third Back to Shanghai film. Yeah, they're all coming from some organization as well.
Yeah, maybe there's good societies and bad societies. Some not using their powers for good and what have you. But yeah, that's a good point. We got a funny Kenny B, not me, extended cameo as a somewhat unstable looking mainland robber robbing the rich, which is obviously them all referencing, you know, that they're a big circle kind of mainland gang who's come to Hong Kong and rob a la Long Arm of the Law. We actually have a cast member or two from Long Arm of the Law showing up in this scene. But Kenny B, I'm a great fan because I think he is an underrated comedic performer. And him with his, like, tough voice, I'm a robber, and his wide eyes just amuses me to no end because he doesn't look stable at all, but he is not psychotic. He's just kind of stupid, a little bit. But he does like Anita Moy, and Anita Moy likes him. So there's their little romantic angle that isn't as evident as you think, because there are some twists and turns there when you think they're gonna almost embrace and like be on the same page romantically. That doesn't happen. So it's a funny little side bit in a fairly short movie. It doesn't extend the movie if you don't like it. But wide-eyed Kenny B looking somewhat unstable on screen is good fun for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've always enjoyed Kenny B in comedies. He's especially romantic comedies. If you listen to this show, many of you probably have seen the Incredible Flying Mr. B, which is just kind of out there and insane. But one of my favorite films is actually a Chinese ghost story ripoff called Burning Sensation, which he plays opposite Carol Cheng in that film, supporting cast of Wu Ma. As well. And I think that's just a charming, you know, again, it's basically just Chinese ghost story ripoff, but set in modern day. But it's still, it's got some nice, nice aspects to it. It's more of a Peking or Cantonese opera thrown in as one element. And he's great, and they have good, very good chemistry in it.
I remember liking it. It's one of those might be seen as a fluff piece of the 80s, but still very much enjoyable. And I was about to connect Anthony Chan to a Chinese ghost story. I don't think he's in one of them. He's in one of the Mr. Vampire movies. But regardless, he turns up here, Anthony Chan. It brings up the point that if you look at the movie, there's no constant loss or anything, but it's all throughout very amusing. The atmosphere is energetic, it moves, you got a great vibe via the performers, whether they're doing silly stuff or slightly more subdued honed stuff. And Anthony Chan represents the perfectly silly side of the movie as well, because they have a card game versus him or something like that, and he's a very silly and not disguising his cheating ways in a very clever manner. Because he's sitting there and clearly is doing something under the table, and they're kind of poking him like, hey, come on, gotta do something first. Like, I have magic powers, I'm totally not having cards under the table. He's throwing cards under the table, I think, like, to hit whoever's at the other end of the table, if it's Mantat or not, I don't remember. But it's one of those, like, totally enjoyable for a minute or two. And at this time, I think they just kind of roped in whoever answered the phone, it seemed, because I don't think they cast Anthony Chan way in advance or anything. So I think at certain times they just got a hold of certain performers to come in for a day or a couple of hours, and boom, good silly stuff that isn't dated. And it's a very central gag, so I don't know if you want to mention some minor specifics about the whole one of the Anita Moy Carol Chang face-offs takes place using facial product and a mirror attached to Anita Moy's face. So, without spoiling the whole payoff or anything, do you want to mention anything about this? Because it's one of the more key scenes together, aside from the ending, I suppose.
Yeah, part of the chemistry between these two is that, again, Carol's playing a character who's basically a con artist, and so she's trying to say that she's got these magic abilities as well, and that she's actually much more advanced than Anita's character is. And so she has to come up with creative and clever ways to try and show this off. And Anita's constantly calling on her. She's saying, oh, if you're at this level, then you don't need to eat food. Right? And so they're all sitting around the table eating, and she's starving. And she's like, oh, I'm just going to eat the snowy lotus. And she ends up going and like painting, which I guess because she goes into the room to paint this leaf, and it looks like she's using whiteout. I don't know. Maybe it's something else in the container, but it looks like a whiteout container. And she comes out and she's like, you know, eating the leaf. And Lowell Lowe is here in a role. So we've talked about him doing the theme, you know, from the film.
Composer and actor, indeed. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think that he's a good composer based on how he looks. He just looks like a supporting actor that was doing that in Hong Kong. But I love that at this time we got so many versatile in front and behind the camera performance. I mean, isn't Tats Lau a composer as well? I remember, you know, actor Tats Lau.
Yes, yes, indeed. He and Anthony Wong Yuming had a band, a famous band together for a while.
Yeah, yeah. So the whole mirror bit and Carol Chang teaching May about treating her face well, but they're going to go into a little guest card act here.
And it ends up using like some kind of, I guess, rubber cement or something instead of the facial mask. So, yeah, it's gags like this that I think keep the momentum of the film going. And again, the chemistry of the two women kind of playing off each other, which they, by extension, actually run into some post-credit scenes that we'll talk about as we get towards the end. One thing I do want to say, though, is with regard to some of the action in the film, because the film does have some action sequences, and Anita kind of shifts from, you know, walking around with this kind of hopping dopey gait into some really kick butt fight sequences. There's a scene where, you know, we've talked about, for example, you know, Stephen Chow referencing, you know, Bruce Lee before, and we get again more Bruce Lee reference here. Anita has a fight scene where, of course, she pulls nunchucks out, right? Because everybody just carries nunchucks right there in the middle of your back. So they're just there, always ready to go. But then she kind of whips it further into this kind of extendable flail. And one thing I've always loved about her is her, because of her background in singing and dance, she has always been amazing at selling great action scenes. And even here, too, I mean, it's one thing to do, you know, physical action, kicks and things if you're a dancer, but she's like whipping these, you know, this staff and these nunchucks around in some of the shots and doing pretty well. And meanwhile, we get a for comedic relief, Lowell Lowe trying to use a pair and basically just defeating himself.
Like hitting herself like 10 times or something. You're right. She brings the grace. I wasn't sure of if she had a dancing background or not watching this. I'm sure I've read it a million times, but it clearly shows, and she's doubled very well. I mean, at points where it's suitable. And she does at least, I don't know, 70% of this action scene, at least, which is totally admirable. And we get a big old, as you alluded to, Fist of Fury moment, but added nunchucks. And one of her particular magic abilities is, it's so surreal, she's has the skill of essentially just pushing objects into people, not like impaling them, but into people, literally
phasing through people, sort of like Kitty Pryde from the X-Men. She can like touch something and make it go inside of you, which is kind of an interesting power to have,
which they do here without extensive effects, man. I mean, it's today it would be So much CG fakery, but here it's just a matter of a few effects shots, possibly, but still just doing it through careful camera composition and shot composition and editing, and there you go. I mean, it's so surprising to see one of the henchmen that turns up for this action scene, he's got a nunchuck in his head, and you think, oh, that's gonna hurt, but no, it's about the power, the magic power. It's just it's now in his head, so it's not like this blood spurting out of his head and he falls, drops dead or anything. It's a very well conveyed gag, which extends to Umantat, who accidentally, I think, gets a goldfish bowl shoved into his stomach.
And then he's speaking and vomiting fish in the follow-up scene, and I had to go back and rewatch it. I think they've got a cut where he first spits out two fish and says some lines, and then there's a break, and then he's got two more fish that come out again. So he's like, he spits up like four fish in total, but it's really funny because he's got these fish in his mouth and he's just bloop, bloop, they're just kind of plopping out. And he gets a Bruce Lee moment too. There's a very funny slow motion sequence where he gets involved in the fight, Umantat, and he does the classic pullback and punch. And it's funny because they leave his arm out there and his arm subsequently gets whacked by a bystander off screen who's like, you know, holding a stick. And so he's got not only the, he's got the wah, you know, slow motion reaction, but then he's got this reaction of pain when his arm gets, you know, smacked by this thing. And again, it's playing to the, that notion, but it's also kind of playing to his comedic talent as well.
And yeah, the movie doesn't stop just because there is action here and bloody gunplay. And one great gag within the gunplay sequence is almost on the theme of the bad gag in From Vegas to Macau, where Chow Yun-Fat could mimic gunfire using his mouth, gunfire effects. Here, Umantat has, thankfully, a couple of rows of firecrackers at his disposal. So he's lighting them one by one to hold off the bad guys who thinks there's bullets coming their way based on the noise that the firecrackers make. Also very well thought out, actually, and well sold by Umantat as well. So they kind of can pass quickly, but I think there's sharp treatment here of these gags. And as I alluded to in my quick opinion, a lot comes from Jeff Lau and Corey Yoon together, because sometimes certain movies involving comedians, Stephen Chow or not, comes off as clearly being steered by the comedian at hand here, and the directors bring something technically, possibly. But here you got a case of, because it is so funny, and with new performers largely, that you got a case for that Jeff Lau and Corey Yoon are very sharp in their like comedic thinking and how to portray this, whether slightly low-key or very broad. They do it twice, obviously. All for the Winner worked out quite well, and I think this, in all honesty, I think it works out a bit better than All for the Winner. And that's not due to like Stephen Chow being bad in All for the Win. I just think this is somewhat more enjoyable. Maybe because we've got a lot more performers here and more pairs or something like that. But indeed, it's not a lesser sequel, I guess is my point. The finale does vary up matters a little bit compared to All for the Winner. We get the card rubbing and the card changing. And by this point, without spoiling it, Paul Chun he's received some help from the character Lao Shun plays, who was briefly in God of Gamblers 3 back to Shanghai as kind of the dynasty warrior. They bring back the whole Magic Powers Association. Paul Chun isn't as handicapped in this movie, let's just say that, because you got multiple masters helping out here for the gambling finale, so that's a change. But it also gives Carol a chance to really command the screen in a way verbally, but also just it stays true to her character as a swindler, because they need to stall the game. So for a good 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, she is wonderful, going like trying to figure out new ways to stall the game while Paul Chun is getting infuriated in the background. So I really dug that. So I won't go into much details personally, but the way she just all of a sudden has left the gambling table and is interacting with someone in the audience is an example of good comedy created in editing as well. So I think if you didn't like Carol before in the movie, I think this last scene is going to turn you around. She's quite good.
Yeah, I think that she sells it really well. And I think the interesting thing, too, there here that happens is that the directors, they realize that, I guess, especially coming on the heels of God of Gamblers 2, that a lot of the card tricks have been somewhat played out. And so they go for an interesting choice, with the last hand, we will say. That I won't spoil here, but if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. In that it's very different from the final hands of other films to date, really. And it's the only film that I can think of that's kind of gone this route. But then, of course, it's the resolution comes up to the quick thinking and the quick wit of Carol Chang's character, and which then gets us to, you know, a happy moment. And then, of course, then suddenly Stephen Chow is back and very disheveled.
Yeah, that movie and that adventure never happened for us. I'm sure someone had the idea of like, hey, why not make a movie while Singh was away, but it never happened, and maybe it was for the good. It's not like he's not coming back from his time travel adventure, and Wong Jing thought to himself, hey, let's expand on that. I think he's just, it looks like his suit is like stitched together as well. So he's been on a journey that didn't pan out very well. So that maybe that's why Uncle Tat is keeping him at home in God of Gamblers 2. I have no other notes as such, but I wanted to mention two things about the end credits. Depending on the DVD you have, if you have the Megastar DVD, tough, because the end credits is as expected. We've talked about this many times. It has scenes playing underneath it, dialogue, and usually it's not subtitled. On the Megastar DVD, it indeed wasn't. On the Deltamac DVD that came out subsequently, it is. So you get some silly minor scenes. They're fully subtitled, which is very surprising, and one of the few movies that have done so at all, actually. So that's quite amusing. And the trailer I love also, consisting of almost only behind the scenes shots and also flubbed lines and outtakes. We don't hear the dialogue, but it's all music above it. And also, just as a final shot, you see Dodo versus Anita on the gambling table, which is a shot that's not in the film. They just shot it to kind of confuse and tease the audience, which I enjoyed that choice, actually, because it's never on, like, on the cards that they're going to go head-to-head as such. It's just a thing they did and ultimately used for the promotion here. So I enjoy that very much. If there's any doubt that Corey Yoon was only there to do the action, I think this trailer confirms that it indeed was a dual directing duo working here. And it's promoted as that because you see them at one point sitting in like a theater or a cinema together. So it was really official that this is Jeff Lau and Corey Yoon's movie, not just Jeff Lau doing narrative stuff and Corey Yoon directing the two action scenes and acting too. I have no other notes on this wonderful, wonderfully entertaining film. So do you have anything else you want to share, Paul?
Yeah, no, there's just one bit of subtitled point of interest that I'll bring up on. And now, so I've got both versions, but I watched the Megastar version for the rewatch for this one. And I'm not sure if it's exactly the same on the Deltamac Fortune Star version or if they changed it. But there's a scene towards the end where Anita is trying to transfer her power to Carol Chang for the tournament. And she says that she's going to teach her the skill. And in the Chinese, it's like the skill of being able to see through the cards, I think. Something like, it's called like Heaven's Gaze or something. But they translate it as this weird word, which I have no idea where it comes from. If the people made it up on the fly, or maybe this is some kind of, I don't know, French or Italian or Portuguese or some other, you know, language that I'm not familiar with. It's called, she's going to teach her Diviacacusus. I don't know.
Yeah, on there's something akin to that on the Deltamac DVD as well. It sounded like a sort of an Indian word, you know, a Hindu word or something.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is or where it comes from. Yeah, and Lowell Lowe's thing too, where he transforms into some diva power because he's trying to slowly pick up tricks and get Anita Moy's character to teach him, and then he has this moment at the end where his face gets all veiny,
yeah,
and he's like he's emitted power somehow, and I'm still not really clear as to what technique that is that he's learned, if it's like a, you know, the Japanese Super Saiyan technique or some Indian you know, divine technique as well. It's a little bit mysterious for me, so if you know what these things are, you know, write in and leave some comments on the Podcast on Fire page for us.
And as for availability, it's been issued at least 3 times, as this is part of the Star TV catalog. Megastar had a DVD out Deltamac had a subsequent DVD out, and Joy Sales was the latest distributor of this movie. Joy says the CD is still in print and listed in stock, but the DVD is not, and the two other ones they're both out of print as well. So hopefully that means that the DVD will be back in stock, because some of these Joy Sales Legendary Collection DVDs do pop up in stock on the likes of Yes Asia and DDD House, so they don't seem totally absent from the market, these catalog titles, which I think is important to still have on the market, because there's a lot of good stuff here. The transfers might not be like up to snuff in 2015, but I don't really care about that. They're sufficient, despite being quite old transfers from the 90s. But I'm hoping that there will be some repressings and or another distributor stepping in to continue this line of catalog titles that these three companies were responsible for. Thank you again, Paul, for joining me on this 7-movie retrospective plus 1 contemporary movie amidst that brew. It's been a blast, as we said on the main show, talking gambling action movies going back to 1989 up until 2014 and then back to 1991. And if the Wong Jing gets his way, there will be From Vegas to Macau yearly. Great.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you for having me. This has, as you said, been a blast. I've had a great time revisiting these films and having a chance to come on and talk about them with you is always fun and enlightening. And, as I like to say, I'm happy to be here. I am a fan of the show, and any chance that I have to contribute to it as well makes me equally happy.
Excellent. As I said, I've always liked your perspective on it as a fan of these movies, but also your Hong Kong perspective on things is quite dear to me, because there are some things that I can't pick up on, especially when it comes to modern cinema. Whether I care about them or not after I know of them is another matter. But you're always welcome, and I always enjoy these chats, and hopefully it all translates into good podcasting. But regardless, to everyone who followed us into the bonus episode, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed your little surprise, and let us know what you thought. And therefore, it's a quick sign off. So I've been Kenny B, and with me was Paul Fox. So gambling season is over, so say bye, buddy.
Bye-bye.